Welcome to Scholar's Circle. I'm Doug Becker. The events of this past week, and those since the American election of 2020, were presaged by a president who's shown little regard for democratic norms and principles since his election in 2016. In this segment, we examine the authoritarian slide in the United States under the presidency of Donald Trump. Our guests are Andrew Rudlevich. He is the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. He is the author of Managing the President's Program, Presidential Leadership and Legislative Policy Formulation, and the New Imperial Presidency. And George C. Edwards, who is the University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. His books include On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, The Strategic Presidents, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership, and Predicting the Presidency, the Potential of Persuasive Leadership. He's the editor of Presidential Studies Quarterly. Professor Rudlevich, we'll start with you. First, is my description of the presidency of Donald Trump as being more authoritarian, more of a challenge to democratic norms accurate? And if so, how much of an outlier is he from the history of modern presidents?
It's a great question. And by the way, thanks for having me here with you. It's a great pleasure to be with George as well, who, if you had just listed his book titles, we would already be out of time. So it's a really interesting conversation to have, I think, and it's one we're going to be having for quite a while. I think with the Trump presidency, you have a little bit of a split screen, right? In one sense, the use of presidential power, as they've either been handed down from the Constitution or more often delegated by Congress over many years, you know, his extension of those powers, I think, is going to fit into a sort of continuum, right? He was certainly aggressive in the way that he used the war powers or administrative, whether it be executive orders or proclamations, memoranda, or the regulatory state. But I think where we will begin to see the term authoritarianism rightly used is in his attempts to ignore the results of a free and fair election, which is pretty textbook in that regard. But also, I think past scholars have talked about powers and duties of the office. President Trump has used his powers, the executive powers, quite aggressively, as I said, but I think it's the duties where we'll be find the most problematically. And some of those are norms, right? They're not necessarily in law, but norms of communication, norms about interbranch relations and cooperation with Congress, for example, giving Congress information so that it can legislate. Obviously, what you use your powers to do, right? In the case that got President Trump impeached, maybe I have to say impeached the first time. That's a little unclear right now. But, you know, that was the aggressive use again of budgetary powers that are vaguely within presidential purview, but used for something that was quite inappropriate. And so, you know, whether it comes to the president's tone or the president's obviously attitudes towards norms and what we expect a president to act like, it turns out that there were good reasons, you know, not to be, quote, modern day presidential, as President Trump claimed he would be, right? It turned out that modern day presidential meant juvenile. And that's a problem when we're talking about an office that has the authority that it does and that it has built up over years. So I do think there are going to be some places where we say, well, he was kind of like other presidents, except more obnoxious. But then there are others where that obnoxious really sort of morphed into something that was very problematic for the Republic.
Professor Edwards, your reaction to the same question?
Yeah, I think Andy, as I would expect, did a great job. Let me take the ball and run from that. I think this is a very much public relations presidency. Public relations occupied the president's time. It occupied his energy. He spent hours watching TV most of the morning, watching the news. He sent thousands of tweets. He appeared at scores of rallies. It was all about promoting himself. And I think this is where we see the most deleterious effects of his legacy, right here. So he failed in the short term. He failed in his broad goal of obtaining public support for himself or for his policies, none of which were very popular. He did succeed in maintaining his base. But I think there's some other things that are very disturbing, and it's violating long-term norms. So let me just try to illustrate just a couple of these. First of all, we know that his response to any criticism is to demean his opponents. And I think this encourages incivility. I think it corroded public discourse. That is a long-term problem for the American polity. And that is one part of his legacy. He's refused to carefully evaluate the nature of challenges facing our society. So he's misled the public, in my opinion, about serious threats such as Russia on the one hand, climate change on another. We can't forget the pandemic, which was no problem at all, if you recall, just a few months ago. Clearly the most mendacious president we've ever had, probably by a factor of 1,000. I think this is a problem. He's lied about people, about issues, about nations, about policies, about his accomplishments. Just the other day, he said he was the greatest first-term president of all time there's ever been. Well, so I think this accelerates the use of disinformation, a big problem in American society today, a very big problem. And we saw some of the consequences of it on Wednesday. And he distorted the public's knowledge. When the public doesn't actually have a good sense of what's going on, then it undermines democratic accountability. Really at the core of democracy is accountability. But you have to know what's going on to hold people accountable. He also has employed racially charged language. And I think that has helped legitimize the expression of prejudice and increase the salience of cultural divisions and racial and ethnic tensions. That's a problem in America. We just think of last summer, if we have to think back even that far, but we know that that is a serious problem in America. He made us worse, didn't make us better. And finally, let me just add, challenge the rule of law. He undermined the central pillars of democracy. When you challenge the rule of law, the FBI, the Justice Department, they're all corrupt, they're all rotten, they can't be trusted. But also attacking the media fundamentally, fake news. And of course, the integrity of elections. So you're really undermining. Now, this isn't a law that you're breaking most of the time. There's no law, and I don't know how you can actually legislate something about that. But there are norms of civility. There are norms of discourse that other presidents have followed, whether they were liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican. Donald Trump is very, very different. And it's true that most of the people, meaning a majority, which is just 51%, most of the people rejected the tone and the substance of the president's rhetoric. But many Republicans did not. And especially for his co-partisans, I think he distorted the public's knowledge about politics and policy. That's a big problem. He warped their understanding of the policy challenges we face and chipped away at respect for the rule of law and the pillars of democracy. That is a terrible legacy.
Professor Rudlevich, it's fair to say something that George Edwards just said was that there's been some degree of repudiation. I mean, if we look from 2016 to 2020 now, the president lost both houses of Congress and then lost the presidency. Is it fair to say that this sort of democratic repudiation of his, whether it's his style or his policies, we certainly have a discussion as to what exactly was being repudiated, but the repudiation, the lesson here is, I mean, what the president did probably is not a good electoral strategy going into the future, for the Republican Party. Is it fair to say that that's the lesson learned?
Maybe a lesson learned at a national level. And indeed, it was intriguing to see some Republicans criticizing the president on the grounds that Republicans could not win a national election, right, in the popular vote without the Electoral College. So they were actually not angry that he was attacking the election, but rather that the implication was that the Electoral College was problematic because national majorities were beyond the reach of the party as it's currently constituted. So yeah, one lesson would be Republican Party needs to be more inclusive. It needs to try to expand to the middle. You know, this was the lesson after the 2012 election, right? The famous autopsy report that the RNC conducted. And then in 2016, of course, Donald Trump won the presidency by effectively turning that on its head and, you know, instead of expanding to the middle, really doubling down on turnout, you know, of effectively a nationalist base, a white nationalist base. And so that worked, right? It worked against Hillary Clinton. It did not work against Joe Biden. Given the political party's purpose is to win election, obviously that exact model is not going to be what future candidates look to. On the other hand, right, even after an armed, angry mob storms the Capitol of the United States, 100 plus members of the U.S. House and the Republican Party voted to support something they knew I hope they knew, was a lie, right, in terms of supporting the president's claims that there was fraud in the election. Only a handful of senators did so, but even so, that's more than none. Why did they do that? Well, clearly they felt that their electoral interest was, in fact, in continuing the model of base mobilization that the president showed could work, at least localized. You know, there's lots of things we could talk about broadly with regards to polarization and the ways in which people's information stream is quite censored. And this is true, you know, on both sides of the aisle, but perhaps a little less violently at this point, at least outside of the, you know, the MAGA base. I think there are conflicting lessons here, you know, for the party. You are clearly seeing a number of, you know, establishment Republicans, more moderate Republicans who are, you know, upset and rightly so with the direction that the president has pulled the party. As George pointed out, this has been all about Donald Trump, not about party building per se, not about the policies of the party. The Republican National Convention this year didn't even have a platform. Shocking just to think about that in the abstract, right? They did not have a policy platform. The point of the party became to support President Trump. You know, that is a not a recipe for party building or for a party institution that has anything it can move beyond Trumpism with. And so I keep circling back to the point where, you know, yes, it's clearly not a nationally winning lesson, but it could clearly, to the degree that members of Congress and other members of the party think that there are votes to be won, you know, in different parts of the country. We're a very country that elects people geographically, right? So there is going to be a lot of diversity, and clearly this is seen to be a winning message in plenty of places, even if not necessarily as you contest the national popular vote.
Yes, George. Pick up on this just for a second. The president has polarized his base so well that a more moderate strategy, a more civilized strategy, more civil strategy, I should say, it's less likely than you might think. The president just met with the Republican National Committee, and they said nothing at all. There were no complaints. They said nothing at all. They just praised him and gave him sustained applause and congratulations. So it's not clear to me that the Republican Party is going to learn the lesson that we think it ought to learn. Because as long as the base, which is the primary electorate, meaning the electorate in primaries, is polarized, is a Trumpist base, then candidates are going to have to appeal to that base. And I think that it was very interesting that the two people who led in the Senate, the two senators who led the charge to challenge the electoral votes of states on Wednesday and Thursday, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, were both candidates are likely candidates for president, and they want to inherit Trump's base. Well, they're not, and they're trying to inherit it in a fashion which pleases an electorate that has been formed by Donald Trump.
Andy Rulevich, the challenge I have with this is, you know, broadly speaking, what we're describing as populism in a Latin American context, where it really became about personality politics and the support of a specific leader rather than anything ideological. And you've pointed out something that has always sort of dumbfounded me, the choice to not have a party platform and instead declare that the party exists to support Donald Trump, who frankly has not been as ideological as others within the party. He's sort of been all over the road there. So how do leaders like a Ted Cruz or a Josh Hawley, how do they navigate being Trumpist with the distinct hope that Donald Trump obviously is not running for president, because if he does, they can't. Is there a possibility of Trumpism without Trump?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't pretend to know for sure. I do wonder, right, if the if merely aping, you know, Trump's, sort of persona is good enough, right? I mean, there's clearly, there is a certain sense of Trump himself, and you see this in some of the almost religious, or sometimes literally religious, devotion that is paid to him, you know, on social media and the like, and even in, you know, the signs that are brandished and the, you know, the role the evangelical Christians have played in his base of support. You know, it's a very interesting question whether somebody else can actually bear that mantle, right? Without his charisma, without his ability to entertain, right? And what's been interesting in a way, you know, I think a lot of Trumpism, I was talking to somebody back in 2016, and, you know, President Trump comes out of, you know, again, reality television, very much presentation of self, even Norman Vincent Peale, right? The sort of power of positive thinking, everything's great, even though it's clearly not so great, right? If you have COVID. And that is, you know, is all about the sort of perception, appearance. And we were comparing it to world wrestling, right? Fake wrestling. Basically, this Trump rallies have this very WWE vibe, right? There's a lot of sort of, you know, rouse people up and it's a show and everybody kind of knows it's fake and that's kind of part of the fun. So policies are relevant, right? It's about the show. Now, as we saw this week, not everybody quite understands that it's only performance, right? There's, you know, that when the president says fight or when Rudy Giuliani says this is trial by combat, you know, some people might think that that means it's real. And, you know, I think clearly Senators Hawley and Cruz were a little bit taken aback by the fact that not everybody was in on their fun game, right? That they could, you know, challenge the tenets of American democracy for their own effectively personal political profit. As somebody put it, they could free ride on others' integrity, you know, planning for the electoral votes to be counted while they got credit for standing up for Trumpism. I don't know that anybody else is as good at that as he is, right? Or that his mantle transfers to somebody else in quite the same way. There has been talk of a sort of, you know, certainly worried talk on the left about the idea that there would be a more competent, you know, autocrat. Rose, that part of, you know, Trump may have wanted to be an autocrat, but he was really bad at it. He never cared enough about governing to actually, you know, do the hard work to figure out how you might actually shape the trajectory of the United States government. He tore down, for sure. He attacked the Justice Department. He attacked the FBI. He attacked civil servants and expertise and science across the board. But he didn't put anything in their place that really supported him, per se. You know, maybe somebody better at it, it's been argued, would be able to do that, and that would be even more damaging. But, you know, again, I'm not quite sure it works. And the proof will be in the pudding. I actually wonder if somebody, you know, if Donald Trump Jr. is actually the next Donald Trump. He has, you know, not to be too nasty, but no obvious qualifications to do anything else. He doesn't really have any, you know, he has even less political experience than his dad. You know, but nonetheless, he's got the name and the smirk and the attitude. And I wonder if he fits right into that sort of, you know, the reality television side of political campaigning, whether again, that's a majority. I mean, President Trump has never had a majority of the American people on his side. He didn't have a single Gallup poll over 50% during his presidency. He started life, you know, in 2016 with what, 46% of the vote, and he wound up with 47%. You know, it's been this extraordinarily stable support and opposition for as long as he's been on the political scene. So I'm not sure that somebody else can expand that. That said, is there money to be made? Is there political capital to be made in that 47%? Absolutely, and there'll be certainly many contenders for that.
Now, George Edwards, there's elements of this that are decidedly 21st century. The impact of social media, for example, and the sort of media star component of Donald Trump, the kind of personalistic politics where the party really becomes the embodiment of the individual. Is that unique in American politics? Have we had previous presidents or presidential candidates that really did kind of blur the ideological lines and became much more of a personal celebrity rather than a representation of, say, a political ideology or political grouping that we typically would call a political party?
Most presidents have been closely associated with policy views. Some have been more centrist than others, but if you think about sort of notable presidents in modern times, certainly Ronald Reagan was associated with a clear thrust of public policy. So there's a big name. Now, you got two more moderate presidents following him, and George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, but they both had clear thrusts. They stood for things. They didn't take a lot of stances. Did you say, "Oh my gosh, that's amazing. That's impulsive." I never thought that they would take that orientation. You know, that's not what the case was. George W. Bush was clearly quite a conservative president, mostly across the board, a conservative president. Some as an heir to Ronald Reagan. Barack Obama was a liberal president, as you would anticipate. We can go back to Franklin Roosevelt. So this is the personalization of the party is in modern times, I think, quite distinctive. Now, because some presidents, let's say FDR, became so closely identified with the party, but you know that you could say it's personalized because he was in office for a very long time, but he really had an agenda. Clearly had an agenda, and that's what drove the support for the New Deal. Donald Trump, as Andy pointed out, has much smaller agenda. It's not that he doesn't stand for anything. He does stand for things. We know his orientation on immigration. We know that. But he really doesn't have, when he came in, he said he made great promises about healthcare, but he had no healthcare plan. There was no White House healthcare plan. There is not to this day a White House healthcare plan. He had an orientation on taxes. He had a few basic things. And he has broad orientation, let's say, on environmental protection. I want to deregulate, I want to deregulate anything I can deregulate. So there's some very, very broad orientations, but you can't identify very many policies. There's no infrastructure plan. If you recall, that played a big role in campaigning in 2016. There is no infrastructure plan. There never was a real infrastructure plan. Nothing has gone anywhere. We know that in the last 2 years in Congress, the president took fewer stands on issues than any modern president. There was nothing there. There were certainly Senate nominations of judges, what I'm trying to say. So there was that. So that's an agenda. But beyond that, there was basically nothing. He wasn't pushing anything. He didn't talk about anything. When it came to the pandemic relief bill that we've just seen pass, the president was almost completely disengaged. When we came to the defense bill that we just saw, the president again disengaged. He's been disengaged from so many policies. When it comes to the Russian cyber attack, where's the president? The president's disengaged and in denial, apparently. So this is typical of Trump. He's just, as Andy said, he's not really driven by policy. He's driven by being president. He's driven by, I would say he's driven by his a need to satisfy his ego. But at any rate, he's not driven by policy. He doesn't wake up in the morning and think, "Oh, I wonder what I can do to advance policy today."
Andrew Rylewicz, sort of last question for you. In the beginning, you said that there is this kind of a distinction between the powers and the duties of the presidency, and that certainly President Trump exercised the powers quite extensively. Do you think the likely reaction to this is going to be a stripping back of some of those powers, or is the expansion of power under the Trump presidency something that's likely to continue and possibly even expand?
In classic political science fashion, I have to say, well, it depends, because I think it is pretty contingent in a different number of areas. So, for example, George just pointed out correctly, the president has almost no legacy in legislative achievement. There's nothing, you could look at the tax cut bill, that's way back in 2017. Certainly plenty of judges confirmed. Very little else that you would say passed by Congress within a four-year period that has sort of a Trump imprint, maybe a criminal justice bill. But if you want to look for things where the president exercised influence, where Congress passed something that they would not have passed if he were not president, I don't know if there's anything on that list, to be honest. We could think about it more. Congress wanted tax cuts. Congress, especially Mitch McConnell, wanted all these judges in office. They were delighted to have a conveyor belt of nominees, for sure. But, a President Rubio elected in 2016 would have had a pretty similar list of people, probably. So, on the legislative side, not that much. On the administrative side, right, a lot of use of regulatory powers. you know, obviously executive orders, some of which are frankly press releases, but others of which have some impact. You know, efforts again to shift the orientation of the civil service to politicize it effectively. We'll see again how much of that lasts into a Biden administration. You know, some of the trade negotiations that have gone on, again, often under the guise of emergency powers, right? And this has been an interesting, you know, aspect of your question. The president has often invoked emergency action, and that's been true, of course, for the so-called emergency on the southern border that he used to move money around to build the wall that he could not achieve, again, through legislative means. It's been true of trade acts, where he's, you know, claimed national security exemptions to keep, you know, steel out of the United States, for example, and raise prices, including, you know, steel from the European Union and from Canada. It's been true for arms deals that he's made that Congress has tried to block. It's been true, you know, even in smaller things, you know, placing economic sanctions on the governance of the International Criminal Court, right? How do you do that? Well, you actually declare a national emergency against those individuals. I mean, it's a bit ridiculous if you drill down into it, but all of those are things that Congress over time has given the president power to do. And so where I think you might have some rolling back would be in, you know, what are the president's emergency powers? How long should they last? Are they really the default? Or, you know, perhaps Congress might need to affirmatively confirm that there is an emergency, right? Because right now the law just says, you know, the president can define effectively what an emergency is, and that activates a number of latent powers in statute. You know, there's a lot of discretion in the law. You know, Trump v. Hawaii, right? The travel ban case. The Supreme Court looked at the Immigration Act and said, you know what? This is extraordinarily deferential to the president. We really can't overturn what he did. And so maybe you would see Congress pay more attention then to, you know, the breadth of what they are delegating over time. Some of the things, though, you know, for example, the president refusing to give information to Congress, even when he's being impeached, and that became in its own article of impeachment back in 2019. You know, a lot of this is up to Congress to have the, you know, the stamina, but also the institutional pride to actually enforce its own rules, right? The War Powers Resolution, the Intelligence Oversight Act, you know, the Impoundment Control Act, you know, all this stuff is on the books already. Congress has not enforced it to any degree, you know, and so if Congress wants to, you know, wrest budgeting, war powers, ethics back from the executive branch, it will actually have to do so. And so the reason I say it depends, well, I don't know what Congress is going to do. You know, we have a Democratic majority. Are they going to stand up to a Democratic president, or are they going to do what Congresses have done for quite a while and say, oh, it's my own guy in there now. It's all good. The next guy might be a dictator. My guy is a strong leader.
We've been discussing the legacy of President Donald Trump, the Trump administration, this drive towards increased power and potential, you know, authoritarianism from the presidency, and what the future may hold in the relationship between the presidency and Congress and broadly with the powers of the presidency. Our guests have been Andrew Rylewicz, the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. He's the author of Managing the President's Program, Presidential Leadership and Legislative Policy Formulation, and The New Imperial Presidency. And George C. Edwards, University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. His books include On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, The Strategic President, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership, and Predicting the Presidency, The Potential of Persuasive Leadership. And he's told me that he's got a new book coming out this year that you should be on the lookout for, discussing the Trump presidency. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.